51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tunefest Dungarvan is an emerging traditional Irish music festival. It will take place in the harbour town of Dungarvan, County Waterford, later this month. The festival plans to bring together traditional Irish musicians, singers and dancers from Waterford, from around the country and from overseas for one weekend. Big focus of Tunefest is to encourage the next generation of musical talent. With this in mind, they've set up a day of workshops for banjo, fiddle, accordion, concertina, whistle and bowron. They will also have headline performances from Dervish, Danu and Glasgow five-piece Imar. Delighted to be joined from our Cork studio this evening by Dunica Goff, Donal Clancy and Sarah O'Gorman. And we're going to start with two tunes, Paddy Ryan's Dream and Repeal of the Union. Two tunes to get us going on this Monday evening, Paddy Ryan's Dream and Repeal of the Union. And that played for us by Dunica Goff on bowron, Donal Clancy on guitar and vocals and Sarah O'Gorman on fiddle. Great tunes they were too. I'm going to come to you on them, Sarah, because I'm presuming that the tunes possibly came from you, Paddy Ryan's Dream and Repeal of the Union. Where did you get them? Are they Munster tunes?
I suppose Paddy Ryan was a fiddle player from North Tip, so I think that's where. Yeah, so I suppose they are. I suppose Munster tunes, but and Repeat at the Union. I actually heard that from the playing of Liam O'Connor, Dublin fiddle player, on his CD. So yeah, no, they're two great tunes now. So
yeah, they were a great way to get the program off on this Monday evening. We're speaking to the three of you, to Sarah, Donal, and Dunica, ahead of Tunefest at Dungarvan. Dunica, you're a musician yourself. We heard you on the bowron there, and you're one of the organisers of the festival. What is the basic idea behind Tunefest? What do you want to achieve with this festival?
I suppose what we want to achieve, we just want to bring people together and have a great weekend, as you said yourself, of music and song and dance. And of course, you said there's a big influence on the youth of the area, because that area, Dungarvan and Ring and the surrounding areas, is full of musicians. You know what I mean? It all started off years ago with local Colts branches teaching kids, and it's brilliant. You know what I mean? There's a massive amount of musicians around. So we just wanted to kind of have a festival and showcase what we have down around this area, because it's great what we have. And what we have too is we've got a really beautiful harbour town, Dungarvan. it's a stunning town, and the town has come to life after COVID. We got outdoor seating and things like that from the council, and it's a great place. We have a gig rig on the square, and I suppose we normally did gigs and concerts, and this year now we're trying to bring the outdoor element into it. Like, and a friend of ours, Benny McCarthy, who we were in the group, Danu, came along to one of the committee meetings, and Benny has great ideas. So every idea Benny has costs a whack of money. You know what I mean? Like, so we're great. And we're on the programme trying to promote the festival.
Let's try to get people down there. And I know that you come from a background where you grew up in a pub where there were lots of sessions happening in that pub. So music was very much part of your background. Was it there from childhood, Donnacha?
Yeah, I'm here with my childhood friend, Donald Clancy. Like, we're playing together since we were 10 years of age, I suppose. And that's 40 years ago now, you know what I mean? Like, where I'm 48, he's 48. His father was a big influence on my life, Liam Clancy. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be playing a bar on here tonight on the radio only for Donald. And we were just coming up in the car here tonight, and we're talking, Jesus, my son is doing his leaving at the moment. And when we were doing our leaving, we left our biology exam half an hour into the exam to play at a wedding in Cork, Lothermore House. We passed it there on the way in tonight. You know what I mean?
Maybe not a recommended route towards the biology exam, but nevertheless.
My own son is the same as me, but you know what I mean? Like,
And obviously, Donal, Donnacha mentioning it there, your father, you're the son of the late Liam Clancy. Growing up in a household like that, I wonder what was the attitude from your side to music? Because you can't underestimate, you know, what the Clancy brothers and what Tommy Makeham and the Clancy brothers achieved in terms of Irish music. Was that a big kind of shadow on your shoulder in some ways, or how did it work for you?
It wasn't at all. We lived in a community there in Ring, just on the other side of Dungarvan Bay, and the community was steeped in great music and song. So I had it coming from all angles, from in the home and from the community. And it's the way I grew up. I can't compare it to anything else.
Yeah, so it was just normal for you for there to be loads of people singing in the house. But you didn't... did you stick with instrumental playing for a long time, I think, until after your father's death? Am I right in saying that?
I did. I was very shy about singing. And I was very interested in the guitar, playing the guitar, playing instrumental music on the guitar. And I played with lots of bands as a rhythm guitar player. But I started out with my father and my cousin Robbie O'Connell. We had a trio, and I'd sing the odd verse, and I'd sing on choruses and that kind of thing. And I built up a little bit of confidence as time went on.
And that didn't have to do with the brilliance, obviously, of your father as a singer. Was it just an innate shyness that singing was behind an instrument was fine, but singing was just a bit too much up front for you?
Yeah, I used to go down and play with Dunica. His parents had Mooney's Pub there in Ring. And I go down playing, and we'd be having a session, a few friends. And if somebody found out I was Liam Clancy's son, then they'd be, go on, sing us a song, sing us a song. I say, it was easier not to sing than be told to sing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. If you just started it yourself, it might happen. But if people start looking for it, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, ease into it.
In your case, Sarah, obviously, we're talking about the same set of communities for all three of you. In your case, Sarah, was there a big family background? I know that you've just recently won All-Ireland titles at the Flagpole, haven't you?
Yes, I have. So I am, I suppose, the current senior All-Ireland fiddle champion. At Flagpole na hÉireann in Mullingar in 2022, and I also, I suppose, took away the miscellaneous senior competition as well, and I'm also a member of the senior Ceilidh band who won at Mullingar last year, Taobh na Mara. So yeah, we're doing a bit of touring now at the minute, but I suppose I had a musical, I suppose, background as well. Like, my granny used to play Biddy Nugent, and there used to be a trio, I suppose, touring around Waterford, Tom, Bob and Biddy, and they used to play for the Polka Sets.
Yeah.
All around. Sure, Polka Sets is a massive thing in County Waterford. So I suppose I was hearing, like Donal, I suppose I was hearing it from all angles as well, like being fully immersed in it, and just, I suppose, hearing Granny play, like when I was growing up, like I suppose it was always in my mind. And sure, she used to play the fiddle, so that was the route that I wanted to take as well. So,
and obviously, with all of that, there's a lot of teaching that will come alongside it. I know that's pretty much what you're involved in as well, and the workshops are a big part of the festival. But I am going to do now, Donal, what you hated having done to you when you were younger. I am going to ask you to sing a song. Have you got a song for us?
We're going to sing an old humorous sea song called Paddy West.
All right, let's have a listen then. Paddy West.
As I went out walking down London Road, I came to Paddy West's house. He gave me a feed of American hash and he called it Liverpool Scouse. He said there's a ship that's a wanting hands, an honour you'll quickly sign. The mate is a tyrant, the bosun's worse, but she will suit you fine. Put on your dungaree jacket and walk up looking your best, and tell them that you're a poor sailor lad that came from Paddy West. Now when we had a feed me boys, the wind began to blow. He sent me up in the attic, the main royal fore to stow. But when I got up in the attic, no main royal could I find. So I turned jacket and walk up looking your best, and tell them that you're a poor sailor lad that came from Paddy West. Now Paddy, he piped all hands on deck, your station's for to man. His wife, she stood in the doorway with a bucket in her hand, and Paddy cried out, and she flung the water away, saying, clew up your forestay gansel, boys, we're taking in the spray. Put on your dungaree jacket and walk up looking your best, and tell them that you're a poor sailor lad that came from Paddy West. There's only one thing for you to do before you sail away. Just step around the table with the bullocks on display, and if they ask were you ever at sea, you can say 10 times round the horn, you can say that you're a sailor since the day that you was born. Put on your dung
Paddy West, sung for us there by Donal Clancy. Donal, I'm sure you're fed up hearing this, but if I didn't know better, I'd say that was your father singing that. Your voice sounds exactly like him. I guess that's a nice complaint.
It is a nice complaint. I'll never be as good as he was now, but nature and nurture, as they say.
Well, I'm sure he would say to you, don't need to be me, be yourself, and that'll serve you well. And you might pass on some of the Clancy family secrets in some of the singing workshops, perhaps, if you're involved in those. Listen, lovely to speak with the three of you this evening. Thanks so much for being with us. That's Donacha Gough on Byron there. I'd like to find out how you sound, made that sound like three instruments as well. Donacha Gough on Byron. Got Donald Clancy on guitar and vocals, and Sarah O'Gorman on fiddle. And the Dungarvan Tunefest Dungarvan is on from the 23rd through until the 25th of June. Tickets available on eventbrite.ie, or you can go in person into the local in Dungarvan, and she might even give you a bit of a song while you're there. Tonight on Arena, in two items, a play and a book, we're going to explore some of the dark social history of Ireland. Later on, we'll be talking to Tim Murta about his book on the tenements of Dublin. But right now, I'm joined by playwright Colin Murphy, who in his past plays has looked at key historic events. His latest play, The Asylum Workshop, is an exploration of mental health in Ireland and in particular, the incarceration of people in asylums. Just to give you one alarming statistic, in the entire history of the Magdalene laundries, an estimated 10,000 women went through them. On any one night in the mid-1950s, there were more than twice that number of people in Ireland's various psychiatric hospitals. One of the most notorious of the Irish mental hospitals was Grange Gorman in Dublin, now the campus for the new Technological University of Dublin. And Colin Murphy has worked with the students of TU Dublin on the play, The Asylum Workshop, and he's with me in studio this evening. As I said, Colin, even just that one statistic is absolutely and totally alarming. Largest form of institutionalisation ever to existed here, and apparently, the largest such system in the world.
Yeah, figures found by Dr. Damien Brennan in Trinity. There were more people in our psychiatric institutions proportionally, pro rata, in the 1950s than there were in Russia. Mm. The Soviet Union was the second highest, you know, and more than three times the rate in Britain, for example. Kind of extraordinary and kind of a forgotten institution. After like two decades of us interrogating our institutional past, I've wondered for a long time why the mental hospitals, the asylums, as they were known then, doesn't seem to have come quite on that radar, you know, in contrast with the Magdalene laundries.
So you're, in some ways, you're dramatising this for us. You're dramatising not just these events, but these statistics. I suppose you're humanising them in the process of doing that.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the brief was, the ask was, Colin, will you go into the archives and write a play for our students, our final year, our graduating drama students, so they're now professional actors, they've just finished, based on the history. And so I went into the archives in the National Archives and you know, like at first it felt very like this overwhelming looking for a needle in a haystack, because I go in and I'm looking for a narrative. I'm looking for a hero to go on a journey, to use that cliche. Mm. And I've got 200 years. I've got a vast institution and thousands of people who went through it, most of whose lives were very inadequately documented. And if they were documented, it was in that bureaucratic form of archives. So what it became was, in part, the story of the struggle to represent those lives on stage.
Yeah. So, in some ways, you're dramatizing your process of trying to get the play written. In some ways, but you do start in the play. It starts with a scene from Hamlet.
Yes. So, one of the things I found myself looking at was how has, you know, madness, as it would be referred to, been depicted on screen and on stage through history. Mm. And I was really conscious of that kind of as a kind of burden on my shoulder, because we're now much more conscious of our responsibility to people. And of course, one of the famous ones is Hamlet. And of course, the big question about is Hamlet mad? But actually, there is a character in the play who does go, quote unquote, mad, and that's Ophelia. But there's so much little discussion about that.
And as to why is she so upset? Because it could be upset as well.
You know, exactly. Like, would that be coercive control? How would you define their relationship? So I was thinking of, you know, our students might be taking these scenes, you know, I look at One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as well, and part of their process might be working on these scenes. And so we ended up anyway starting the play with actors arguing over, these student actors arguing over Hamlet and Ophelia and the relationship and how madness is represented in that. And that then segues into the uncovering of the history of Grange Gorman.
And do you present actual factual moments in the history of Grange Gorman, of that asylum, or are you representing the character, the people who were incarcerated there? How do you bring that to life on stage?
So there's both. I think what maybe unlocked the play for me was an embracing of the idea that it could be fragmentary and that the history was fragmentary, and that, you know, if I was to attempt to tell a conventional story at the beginning, middle and end about somebody who went through it wouldn't be authentic. It wouldn't be authentic to how the history has been represented in the archives. So I began to think then in terms of, well, what would a TV documentary do? Well, they'd interview some interesting people and they might do some you know, actors dramatizing or reenacting. That you'd see the documents, actors would voice over the documents. And I sort of brought all of those techniques to the stage. So we have both, you know, historical scenes that are actually in the moment, actors in costume. For example, you know, the very start of it, the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, you know, deciding to open this lunatic asylum, which will be named after him, the Duke of Richmond, Richmond Lunatic Asylum. That will be his legacy. So there are actual historical drama scenes. Then there are sort of theatrical representations of the archives. So letters being dramatized, and of some of the characters. There are characters who come to life, but there are also on stage the students playing themselves wrestling with this material and the ethics of how they can and should represent it.
Yeah, because they are taking people's stories and presenting them as, in inverted commas, entertainment. Tell me about Claire Keeley. This is was she one of the incarcerated?
That's a pseudonym, but it's... this was a key moment for me in the research. So I was kind of floundering in the archives and you know, the first thing they brought me when I went into the National Archives was this huge ring binder, and that was the index. And then you start pulling out documents at random, and actually most of them are just very bureaucratic and they're not enlightening. And then they brought me out this thing called the Female Casebook, and it was for the year 1908. And it was mad. They had to bring it out in a trolley. It was this huge, heavy, leather-bound volume, and you turn over the page very slowly and carefully, and there's a photo. And this is where they recorded the admissions, and they had a photo studio, and they took these. I mean, they're stunningly beautiful, perfectly preserved, more than 100 years later, black and white photographs of each woman who came in that year. And there'd be a page of admission details, and then they would start taking the case notes, and there'd be three pages, I think, of space for case notes. And if the woman was discharged within a year, that'd be enough. But if she remained, they'd have to find space for her elsewhere in the book. And there'd be a little note saying, go to page 345, and you'd go, and there'd have been a half page empty on 345, and you'd find Claire Keeley's story picked up there. So this Claire Keeley's story kind of wove through this huge book. And so she came in 1908. She was suffering from delusions. Now, the delusions were pretty mild. She was seeing cousins of her husband who lived in Australia, and she thought they were in the house. She thought somebody was a lord in the family. It wasn't a lord. So mild enough. But anyway, the husband brings her in. And the precipitating incident, as far as he believed, was that a few weeks earlier, a neighbour had a fight with his wife and accused her of having children illegitimately. So immediately we're starting to fold in that whole 20th century narrative here of Irish sexual morality and the incarceration of women. So that's the precipitating incident for her. And the doctor then writes in the notes that he suspects a cause is prolonged lactation. She's two very young children. So she comes in suffering from delusions. There's very detailed notes initially, very concerned. And then the notes start to get sparser and sparser and thinner and thinner the longer she stays there.
And you also, as well as the students performing, in some cases, I suppose, playing the characters of people like Claire, or you say that's a pseudonym, you also have expert opinion, contemporary expert opinion being given to us here as well.
Yes. So there were points where the archive literally defeated me. Like, for example, letters from, you know, mid-20th century, so quite recent, talking about girls who had been transferred, in one case from a Magdalen laundry, in another case from a reformatory school, for behaviour that was described as disruptive. Laughing in chapel was what the girl in the Magdalen laundry was up to. And what happened? They got ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. And I thought, well, that's actually unstageable. So I brought these to Professor Brendan Kelly, psychiatrist at Trinity, who's involved in the broader Grange Gorman Histories project. And how he talked about the letters was so interesting. I thought, actually, I want this on stage. So we have one of the actors playing Brendan Kelly. So in a sense, there are points where the play as a play breaks down, and we go explicitly into documentary because it's just the best way to tell that story with integrity.
You came across some incredible treatments, very upsetting, appalling treatments for mental illness. What were the ones that stood out for you, or is there one that did stand out?
I think the most bizarre is malaria treatment. So they were, you know, collecting. Initially, they were trying to collect mosquitoes in customs, because I guess mosquitoes would come in on travellers and goods, because there was, in fact, they did have statistics, but the statistics weren't really very good. But the belief of the time was that malarial infection could cure a general paralysis of the insane. So they were trying to induce, they were trying to give people malaria. And I think the thinking was that the body fighting off the malaria would help, would have side benefits. More distressing, though, was the insulin treatment because of how prolonged that was. So this was the idea that if you, and again, like there was statistics at the time that appeared to show that it worked, though, like the risk was, the side effects were extraordinary. The idea was you use insulin, you induce a coma, you then give glucose to take the patient out of the coma, and by some process that they didn't understand, the patient has better. But they would do that every day for 50 to 60 days.
And by some process that they didn't understand being the important thing within all of that. The current campus now, the TU campus in Grange Garman, is a wonderful series of modern buildings with some of the older buildings still there as well. What was it like, or what has it been like, to develop this project on that campus? And in some ways, I suppose, to reclaim that campus and state it, maybe acknowledge the past, but to try to move forward. Is that what this is about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very special. The director, Peter McDermott, talks about a Japanese stomping ritual where apparently Japanese people, when they come into a place like that that has a history, they perform this to kind of earth themselves and to pay tribute to, I suppose, the ghosts, if you like, who've gone before. And the play felt very like that, and particularly when you talk to the actors who've been students there for a number of years, and you know, how it felt working within those walls, and the play really felt like a connecting and with the history and embracing of that history.
That's about, that is what it's about. It's not ignoring it. It's presenting it, and then maybe
trying to do some kind of justice and honour to the people who spent their lives there.
The Asylum Workshop is the title of the play that Colin Murphy has been speaking to us about. It is on at the Black Box Theatre in TU Dublin, in Grange Garman, and it is there from June the 14th through until the 24th. A new four-part drama begins tonight on BBC One. It stars Sharon Horgan and Michael Sheen as a married couple caught up in any parent's worst nightmare, a desperately sick child. Best Interests is written by Jack Thorne. Niamh Moriarty plays their daughter Marnie, who has muscular dystrophy. Her condition has deteriorated so much that doctors are advising palliative care as the only option, something Sharon Horgan's Nikki just cannot accept. Alison Oliver plays the older sister, Katie. Jen Gannon has been watching it for us, and she joins me in studio now. Desperately aware that this is a very difficult topic. I mean, and there may well be people tonight who are going through similar situations or parallel situations. But maybe give us the setup of this fictional family, Jen.
Yeah, I think really with Jack Thorne, as we know from his previous work, like he's done everything really from Shameless, Skins, This Is England, like he wrote for all of them, up to, you know, Then Barbara Met Alan, which was about disabled activists. So he's really digging into this situation again about what, how your life changes, but also how, you know, families adapt to their circumstances. And this family with Nikki and Andrew, they are
Nikki and Andrew being Sharon Horgan and Michael Sheen.
They're both, like, we start off with them, you can see them as a married couple being very much in love, and they're on a train after coming from a romantic mini break, and they're laughing and joking and, you know, feel like, you know, a really strong couple. But, and it's really not, they're trying to show it as it is obviously a horrendous situation that they're in, but their home life can be full of beauty and happiness. And when they come home, they have their two daughters who they obviously love very much, and they're being taken care of by a friend. And you do see that affection that they all have for each other, and how they kind of row in together with a bit of, you know, a slight dark humour there as well. But, you know, obviously the focus is on Marnie, 13-year-old Marnie, who is, you know, played exceptionally by Niamh Moriarty. She's a Dublin actress, and I think she really has a hard, you know, role to inhabit, because you don't want to make this child too angelic, as it's unbelievable, because it is rooted in reality. Now, it's not based on a true story. Jack Thorne actually took many different stories from different families going through the situation that he met and kind of combined them all together. So what happens is you end up, because you feel like you're so aware of how this partnership works between the two parents, when you see the fractures begin, when Marnie has, she has to, she has actually actually a seizure, and she ends up in hospital, and they are worried it's a brain injury. You see the first kind of fracture there between the parenting styles and how they treat their daughter and what they want for her.
Let's have a listen to a clip, and this is very early on in the series, so we're not giving anything away in the first episode. Marnie, Niamh Moriarty, has had this severe chest infection that you've been speaking about there, Jen, and Nikki, the mum, played by Sharon Horgan, Andrew, the dad, played by Michael Sheen, get news from two doctors, Dr. Samantha, played by Noma Dumavzveni, and Dr. Nescott, played by Jonathan Rhodes.
I think it won't work. I'm really sorry.
Why don't you just say what you want to say, okay? Because this dancing around, it's not helping anyone.
What exactly are you saying?
You're saying that she wants her to die.
No. No, that's not. We believe it's time to consider, just consider, moving her to supportive care only. And yes, that is why I have invited Dr. Nescott.
We can make her comfort the top priority.
She still laughs. She still loves. She's still, I can still see so much inside her.
She's a smashing girl, but her body is failing her.
Right, well, then we start talking about more experimental treatments. Okay, vamorolone has worked for Duchenne's, Zolgensma, for SMA, you know, something like that. One of those or something like that.
Nikki, she's deteriorating rapidly. And increasing medical intervention will have less and less impact on her life expectancy. But more importantly, they will hurt her. I am really sorry.
Even just listening to that clip is incredibly difficult. That's a clip from the new BBC series Best Interests. And in the voices we heard there were Sharon Horgan as the mother, Nikki, Michael Sheen as the dad, Andrew, and the two doctors played by Noma Dunamizaveni and Jonathan Rhodes breaking that really difficult news to the two parents. I was asking you as we were listening to that, Jen Gannon has watched this BBC series for us. When you hear the names Sharon Horgan and Michael Sheen attached to something, the presumption is, well, there's going to be a few laughs along the way. I don't think this is what you're going to get in this series.
No, with Sharon Horgan, it's something very different. I know that, like, you know, with Bad Sisters, there's a dramedy element to it, but this is very different for her. And I think she really gives it her all. And it's a really, both of them have, it's a very powerful performance from both of them in different ways. Because with Michael Sheen, he's the kind of the softy, and he is quietly devastated. And you can even hear there with Sharon Horgan, she is this powerhouse, and she is determined, you know, not to have her child put in this position. And she also feels like a lot of women are done by decisions made over her head. She feels by doctors behind closed doors, you know, that are making decisions that will affect her life and without her say so, without her consent. And you do see that there is a touch of that where she says, you know, she left her job because she was having difficulties with her pregnancy and difficulties with childcare, that it became too much for her and she had to leave her job. And it's all about that, the slowly, when people have somebody in their family that is very sick, the changes that society, the rubrics that are not, they're not in place for them to live a fulfilling life, and those decisions that even have to be made.
Yeah, so we have the challenges for the parents, obviously, but there are two children involved here as well, not least of whom is Marnie, the character who is ill, and as we know from there, that, you know, terminally ill, effectively, played by Niamh Moriarty. And there's another child, an older sister, slightly older sister, Katie, played by Alison Oliver. People may remember her from
Conversations with Friends.
Yeah. She was Frances, the lead, one of the big characters at the head of that of that cast. How does the child-parent dynamic play out?
For me, I feel like it really does excel when it concentrates on the life of Katie, the older sister, because, and I think Alison Oliver is fantastic in this. Like, she is just a real quiet wonder. Like, she's one to watch in the show's secret weapon for me. Like, she gives this performance where she's a teenager and she's dealing with this guilt around, you know, her mortality and her quality of life when she's enjoying herself doing those teenage things. Like, you see her falling in love, she's having her first relationship, and she feels guilty because she knows that, you know, her sister's time, her younger sister's time on this earth is limited. And you see that you're watching her in this mix of pleasure and pain, and she also has this level of resentment to deal with as well, because her parents effectively are abandoning her because they're giving their sole focus to Marnie, and they're largely absent from her life, and, you know, they're missing out on seeing her becoming an adult. And I think her story is where I think it's good for the audience to kind of hook in and understand those emotions and see those emotions playing out. And I think she does it really terrifically. It's a tough watch though, all around, in that way.
And there's another aspect of here. We don't just see Marnie, and we see other seriously ill children as part of, and remember, this is a fiction, albeit that Jack Thorne may well have gathered material from factual research, but this is a fiction. We see other seriously ill children, and we get a notion of, I suppose, the difficulties that doctors and nurses have to face in those situations.
Exactly. And also, I think, you know, the parents, other parents themselves, because I think Lenny Rush is in it, who we would know, he's just won a BAFTA for Am I Being Unreasonable with Daisy May Cooper. And that's another, Jack Thorne produced that show. And Lenny Rush plays a little boy who is in a wheelchair, and he has this kind of affection for Marnie, and he wants to take her out on a date. And you see Sharon Horgan as the mother, you know, kind of wanting to stall the digger on this one and say, I don't think that she's old enough. And then Lenny Rush's character's mother says, this could be their only chance to do this and to experience something that normal kids do as well. So let them kind of live their life. And she almost avoids this woman because his character unfortunately passes away. And then she doesn't want to see her because she doesn't want to be reminded that her own daughter's life is limited. Yeah. But then they see each other again, because there's this moment where Sharon Horgan's character says, oh, she touched my hand, she gripped my hand, she's still alive. She's still alive in there, we can't let her die. And Lenny Rush's character, his mother felt the same way about him. So you're thinking there's all this side to it where it's like the mother's emotions, but then there's also Michael Sheen's character, his side of it, where he's thinking logically, going, is this quality of life for her? Like, is this really where we should be, you know, this girl, maybe she's a husk, maybe this is not what we should be doing for a child.
Without going too far down the plot, that difference in parenting styles and that difference in attitude to the child becomes a major bone of contention, a really big point of debate. But I wonder, and I think you found yourself feeling this at a certain point as well, who is this series actually for? I can't imagine it's a sit down and have a bit of crack and a glass of wine watching this. It sounds like an upsetting watch.
It really pushes a lot of topical issues, especially when it comes with, there's a part in it where Nikki is very desperate, and in blind hope she gets involved with this religious right to life group, and it almost feels too much in those moments. But I do know that, as we said, it is the reality for many people dealing with sick children, and he doesn't shy away from it, but he also doesn't make it have that movie of the week mawkishness. It kind of treads the line, it toes the line carefully enough, and it can be a little bit too sentimental sometimes, and a little bit like it feels like eating your vegetables. But I think, and 4 episodes is a lot for people, I think, to withstand.
4-hour-long episodes.
You know, an audience to take. And I think it might be less draining if it had been a 2 or a 3-parter even, but the performances are so well done. And I think everyone will remember, come awards time, there is a scene with Michael Sheen and Sharon Horgan arguing outside their house in the middle of the street that is so raw and so devastating that you cannot help being blown away by it. So I think it is worthwhile, but I would proceed with caution because it's very upsetting.
So very upsetting, but for all of that, worth putting on the to watch list. That's Best Interests with Sharon Horgan, Michael Sheen, and the two young performers, Alison Oliver and Niamh Moriarty. Sounds like a phenomenal quartet at heading that cast. Begins tonight, BBC One at 9 p.m. I said earlier we would be dipping into our dark past again tonight. This time it's tenement living in Dublin. From the film setting of the period drama to the location of classic plays such as The Plough and the Stars and Juno and the Peacock, and more recently indeed as the backdrop to Anu's living history drama, Living the Lockout, Henrietta Street in Dublin city centre is a core part of Ireland's cultural life. However, the same street has had a much grander and desperate history, a history hinted at in the work of O'Casey and Plunkett and recounted in Timothy Murtagh's new book, Henrietta Street, From Townhouse to Tenement. And, excuse me, Timothy is with me in studio this evening, and I'm going to take a drink while he starts. First of all, maybe you put us, get us to the location, Tim, if you would, of Henrietta Street, just for people who maybe aren't familiar with that particular part of the city.
Yeah, so Henrietta Street is located just at the very top of Capel Street. It's in the northwest of the city. It's funny you mention Joyce, you know, just before we started talking, because the title of the book is called Spectral Mansions, and that's actually a quote from Dubliners,
right,
which is a character describes walking down Henrietta Street from the King's Inns, which is actually at the very top of Henrietta
Street, the big legal part of the city.
Summerhill, yeah. And he's walking down it, and he describes the houses as gaunt, spectral mansions where the nobility of Dublin once roistered, which is a very fancy way of saying back in the 18th century, this is where the creme used to live. And by the time Joyce was writing, you know, it's not that.
It had fallen from grace. But even when you walk down that part of the city right now, particularly when you look up Henrietta Street, it is, you're transported to a different era if you can ignore what's going on behind you in terms of noise yeah. and the feel of the contemporary city.
I mean, it is astonishing. It's one of the first sort of big speculative sort of builds of the 18th century. I mean, even by the standard of the day, that was one of the sort of most impressive addresses. Physically, I mean, those houses, even by the 18th century standards, are impressive. I mean, they're double the width of the plots that you'd get in the 18th century. And if you walk into those even today, I mean, they're cavernous. I mean, the height of the ceiling is 14 foot high in one of those houses. I mean, it's astonishing.
So when was the grandeur at its very best, at its very height? Was it that initial period?
It's that initial period.
So mid to late 18th century,
1750s. I mean, the street starts in the 1720s. It's pretty much complete by the 1750s. And by the 1750s, you know, it's at its height in terms of the political power and influence that's based there. You know, the Lord Chancellor of Ireland, all the various sort of Church of Ireland, you know, sort of Anglican bishops, political leaders, sort of people who sort of make all the deals in the Irish Parliament down in College Green. They're all based there. I mean, it's, you know, people describe Ireland in the 18th century as actually being governed from Henrietta Street, not from College Green, where the Parliament is, because that's where all the power is located.
Yeah, and clearly these were very wealthy men, very wealthy families that were living in this part of the city.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's important, and I sort of mentioned it in the book, which is you have to remember where all this wealth came from, which is, I mean, these are landowners. This is money being extracted from you know, a fairly impoverished peasantry in the countryside, and sort of, you know, if there's agricultural good times, that money's been funneled into the pockets of the landlords.
You're not aware of what's happening down the country or wherever it is happening. Yeah, you're not aware of that in your little, your fine big house in Henrietta Street. So the Act of Union, ironically, in 1800 is the beginning of the decline?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, there's obviously a big argument amongst economic historians about the effects of the Act of Union on Dublin. It definitely had a bad effect, but how much of Dublin's decline in the 19th century is directly a product of the Act of Union is debatable, but it definitely has a huge impact on Henrietta Street. I mean, simply, if there's no longer an Irish Parliament, if there's Irish MPs are now going to London.
The governing was now going to be done from London for all of the various countries in the two islands.
I mean, there's fewer Irish MPs. They get reduced from 300 Irish MPs to only 100. And they're now going to London. So at the end of the 18th century, you've got just under 300 Irish MPs who all keep a Dublin townhouse. You know, 20 years later, there's six of them.
Right.
And those people, and you know, it's not just the houses, they spend money, they buy luxury goods. You know, there's a whole economic sort of
We often hear that, the whole thing about, you know, when something's pulled out of a city, even in contemporary times, when a business closes, it's not just the people directly employed, it's the entire economy around that business. So how gradual or how swift was the decline after the Act of Union?
It's actually gradual. That's the thing. It's not overnight. I mean, it's actually kind of good times for the city up until about 1815, because the Napoleonic Wars are still on. Ireland is the sort of grain bowl for the rest of the UK's war effort. So, I mean, Dublin's sort of benefiting from a sort of strong rural economy. That all changes after 1815. And you slowly see basically Dublin lose out to other cities in the British Isles, in Ireland as well, because it doesn't industrialise. It fails really. There's a few standout industries, but by and large, Dublin doesn't have a strong industrial base the way you see it happen in Leeds or Manchester or even in Belfast. I mean, Belfast is, you know, it's about a tenth of the size of Dublin at the end of the 18th century, and it's probably overtaken it by the end of the 19th in terms of size and population.
Yeah, that's and certainly in terms of wealth.
In terms of wealth,
it had overtaken it. So at what stage then do we start to see what were once these fine houses for the great and the good becoming tenement buildings, effectively being divided up, I guess, into living compartments for families, poor families?
Yeah, well, there's a few sort of precursors to it. So you see it first in Henrietta Street, for example, because it's close to the King's Inn. Lawyers take it over. So the first thing is it goes from being an elite house to lawyers' offices. Mm. Then, say, number 14, which is where the museum is today, that becomes a court, the encumbered estates courts. Then by the 1860s, the Dublin militia take it over and it becomes an army depot, a barracks, essentially. That's there for 10 years. Mm. And then you see it in the 1870s become apartments and it's being let out as tenements. But again...
And somebody's making money there.
Someone's making money,
as well.
Yeah, yeah. A guy called Thomas Vance, actually. He buys number 14 in particular. And he's one of the... You know, he's a big builder. I mean, he's actually... there's still a place called named after him in Black Rock, Vance's Harbour. I mean, he has this absolutely huge house out there. But I mean, yeah. But the one important thing, though, is tenements, there's a story, even when a building becomes a tenement, it often starts out as relatively well from what we can see in terms of, you know, it's quote-unquote a better sort of tenement. That may sound like a contradiction in terms... But in Henrietta Street, a lot of the time in the 1870s and 1880s, they're at the upper end of the sort of rentals. You know, there's provisions, they're not overcrowded. That always just changes and it gradually...
Slowly just depletes.
Depletes. Yeah. By the early 1900s, it's...
So the early 1900s, and I guess then we're into cultural representations of it. You mean the fact that the book, as you say, is called Spectral Mansions, you know, there we have the direct reference from...
Joyce to it.
I'm thinking, though, of, I suppose most people will, when you think of the tenement buildings and representations of them in any sort of cultured way, Sean O'Casey is the first one that springs to mind, isn't he?
I mean, he's the big one. And I mean, it's one of the funny things, though. I talk briefly about it in the book, which is that, you know, we often have this sort of assumption that the tenements aren't well represented in Irish literature because, you know, the dominance of things like Sing, like Playboy of the Western World, of rural depictions in the Abbey, particularly, you know, Abbey plays, apparently, and the joke was they used to be tested for, PQ, peasant quality, to see if they would be, you know, suitably rural. Actually, there's a very strong, I mean, imagine Irish literature without Dublin tenements as a setting, whether it's Joyce or, I mean, O'Casey, that trilogy between 1923 and 26 of Shadow of the Gunman, Juno and the Peacock, Planet of the Stars. I mean, it's astonishing.
And when you look at that, when you look at it with an historian's eye at those three plays, and maybe even think of them as history plays as opposed 100%. To, you know, contemporary dramas, How do they measure up in terms of historical accuracy?
Pretty accurate. I mean, O'Casey is living in a tenement flat in Mountjoy Square, and there's lots of little details. I mean, they're not little details in those plays about what rooms certain characters are in. Are they in the return room, that small box room that's at the back of the stairs, or are they in the front parlor or back parlor? All these names from the 18th century usage, which are now sort of denoting sort of variations, little social class variations.
So class within
the tenement buildings, the depiction of sort of the lack of privacy, the way things happen in the street, depiction of even in one of the plays of a prostitute and sort of their relations with other tenement residents. All these sort of speak to someone who's depicting it fairly accurately from what I can see from the record.
And indeed, the children and the sick children very much part of the story as well, which would have been true to life.
I mean, one of the shocking statistics you get is between 1899, so the very last year of the 19th century, and 1913, Dublin had the highest infant mortality rate in the entire British Isles. Mm. That's a 14-year unbroken record. It's astonishing.
Yeah, and I think I think that statistic might be out there or given as part of Strumpet City, because that's the other great work of literature that deals directly with this. And in fact, when it came to the television series.
So, I mean, the big setting in the same way that, you know, you have Barrytown and Roddy Doyle, you have Chandler's Court, which is sort of the sort of anonymous sort of everywhere tenement in Strumpet City. That in 1980 is filmed in Henrietta Street. And I mean, and it's many people's sort of iconic, you know, images of that really, really great adaptation of it are from Henrietta Street. The ironic thing is some of those houses had only sort of stopped being in effectively tenement apartment use maybe 3 or 4 years earlier. It hadn't been that long ago.
Wow.
I mean, people were still living in, it wouldn't have been the same conditions as 1900 or 1920, but there would have been a fairly dilapidated apartment living in those well into the 70s.
And if my memory served me right, I may be conflating a documentary with Strumpet City itself, but my memory is of, you know, a collapsed or a tenement that fell down, or that there was a fire or an accident of some kind. And that relates to something that happened around the corner from Henrietta Street.
So, I mean, again, obviously Strumpet City is making reference to the lockout. One of the historical incidents it really makes references to is the collapse of a tenement in Church Street, which is right around the corner from Henrietta Street. It's in early September 1913. tenement collapses, two tenement buildings collapse, killing 7 people, including a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Wow.
Now, there's been tenement collapses before in the city. The scary thing is that wasn't the first one, and wasn't the first one that killed people. But that coming up right before or during the 1913 lockout really galvanized a conversation in the city across 1913-14 about housing. The same way the lockout does. People begin to look at, particularly even industrialists and sort of the capitalists, look, would this lockout be happening if the workers of Dublin were better housed? Now, there's other things at stake other than just housing, but that's one of the sort of conversations that emerge in those years.
Yeah, and specifically, I suppose, I touched on it earlier when I mentioned the illness. If you think of Rasher's Tyranny in Strumpet City, or indeed Mulzer in The Plough and the Stars, illness and disease rampant in these tenements.
I mean, there's still smallpox happening late in 1903, you know, sort of decades after they've been sort of eradicated from other cities. Tuberculosis is peaking in the early 1900s. It will take decades to get down. Dublin is an unhealthy city. It has a death rate that's about 1.5 times that of Glasgow, which is sort of notorious as an unhealthy city in the same period. So it really is something that has huge problems. And it stems from a lack of good paid employment and, as a knock-on, very poor housing conditions.
And finally then, when did we move from those buildings being lived in as tenements to then, I guess, becoming practically derelict and in some cases rejuvenated in some way?
There was a very good of, you know, Henrietta Street is sort of coming back to life. I mean, it has been for a while. I mean, there's been people like Ian Dalton and the Caseys in Henrietta Street since the 70s or early 80s. But no, I mean, it's a long story. It's not one single decade. I mean, it's the 20th century from, I'd say, the late 1920s on. It is that huge program of building suburban housing. You know, places like Crumlin, Walkinstown, Marino in the 20s, going out, and the slow sort of suburbanisation and filtering out of the inner city and those real tenement districts. That's going on well into the 60s and 70s.
Well, a bit like the decline, gradual, I guess, if it's going to come back to any form of being lived in any kind of fullness of time, that's going to be a gradual process as well. Yeah. Tim, thanks for coming into us. Very interesting stuff. Indeed, that's Timothy Murta, author of the recently published Spectral Mansions, The Making of a Dublin Tenement, 1800 to 1914. Published by Four Courts Press, fourcourtspress.ie, for more details there. And that is Our Lot.